2.2 The first issue of the Cobble Road Crusader appeared on January 13, 1958. A. Ferguson, the founder and publisher of the Infant newspaper, announced in a front-page editorial that the Crusader would, quote, report the facts to the best of our ability and tell the truth no matter what the cost, close quote. The printing of the inaugural edition of 50 copies was overseen by production manager Rose Ferguson, who took the original handwritten dummy to Meyerson's print shop in West Orange to execute the task of reproducing both sides of the 24-by-36-inch sheet and turning out facsimiles on paper thin enough to be folded in half. And because of that fold, the Crusader entered the world looking more like a genuine news organ, almost, than some homemade, typewritten, mimeographed newsletter. 5 cents a copy. No photographs or drawings, some breathing room up top for the stenciled masthead, but otherwise nothing beyond two large rectangles filled with 8 columns of densely packed, hand-printed words, the penmanship of an almost 11-year-old boy who had always struggled to form his letters neatly. But in spite of some wobbles and misalignments, the results were legible enough, with an overall design that came across as a sincere, if somewhat demented, version of an 18th-century broadsheet. The 21 articles range from 4-line squibs to 2 3-column features, the first of which was the lead story on the front page, with the headline that read, A Human Tragedy, Dodgers and Giants Leave New York for West Coast, and included extracts from interviews Ferguson had conducted with various family members and friends, the most dramatic response coming from fellow fifth grader Tommy Fuchs. I feel like killing myself. The only team left is the Yankees, and I hate the Yankees. What am I supposed to do? The feature on the back explored a developing scandal at Ferguson's elementary school. 4 times in the past 6 weeks, students had crashed into one of 2 brick walls in the gym during dodgeball games, causing an outbreak of black eyes, concussions, and bleeding scalps and foreheads. And Ferguson was agitating for pads to be installed to prevent further injuries. After eliciting comments from the recent victims, I was going after the ball, said one, and before I knew it, I was bouncing off the bricks with a bashed in head. Ferguson spoke to the principal, Mr. Jameson, who agreed that the situation was out of control. I've spoken to the Board of Education, he said, and they've promised to pad the walls by the end of the month. Until then, no more dodgeball. Vanishing baseball teams and preventable head injuries, but also stories about missing pets, storm-damaged utility poles, traffic accidents, spitball contests, Sputnik, and the state of the president's health, as well as brief notices about the current doings of the Ferguson and Adler clans, such as Stork Beats Deadline. For the first time in human history, a baby was born on its due date. At 11:53 p.m. on December 29th, just 7 minutes before the clock ran out on her, Mrs. Frances Hollander, 22, of New York City, gave birth to her first child, a 7-pound, 3-ounce boy named Stephen. Congratulations, Cousin Francie. Or, a big step up. Mildred Adler was recently promoted from associate professor to full professor by the English department at the University of Chicago. She is one of the world's leading authorities on the Victorian novel and has published books about George Eliot and Charles Dickens. And then, not to be overlooked, there was a boxed-in rectangle in the lower right-hand quadrant of the back page that bore the title Adler's Joke Corner, which Ferguson planned to include as a regular feature in all issues of the Crusader. For how could he neglect a resource as valuable as his grandfather, the king of the bad joke, who had told so many bad jokes to Ferguson over the years that the young editor-in-chief would have felt remiss if he hadn't used some of them. The first example went as follows. Mr. and Mrs. Hooper were on their way to Hawaii. Just before the plane landed, Mr. Hooper asked his wife if the correct pronunciation of the word Hawaii was Hawaii with a W sound or Hawaii with a V sound. I don't know, Mrs. Hooper said. Let's ask someone when we get there. In the airport, they spotted a little old man walking by in a Hawaiian shirt. "Excuse me, sir," Mr. Hooper said. "Can you tell us if we're in Hawaii or Hawaii?" Without a blink of hesitation, the old man said, "Hawaii." "Thank you," said Mr. and Mrs. Hooper. To which the old man replied, "You're welcome." Subsequent issues were published in April and September of that year, each one an improvement on the last, or so Ferguson was told by his parents and relatives. But with his school friends, it was a different story. For after the success of the first issue, which had taken his class by storm, a number of resentments and animosities began to surface. The closed-in world of fifth and sixth grade life was bound by a strict set of rules and social hierarchies, and by taking the initiative to launch the Cobble Road Crusader, that is, by daring to create something out of nothing, Ferguson had inadvertently overstepped those bounds. Inside those bounds, boys could win status in one of two ways, by excelling at sports or by proving themselves to be masters of mischief-making. Good marks in school were of little importance, and even exceptional talent in art or music counted for almost nothing, since those talents were seen as inborn gifts. Biological traits similar to the color of one's hair or the size of one's feet, and therefore not fully connected to the person who possessed them, mere facts of nature independent of human will. Ferguson had always been reasonably good at sports, which had allowed him to fit in with the other boys and avoid the dreaded fate of outcast. Mischief-making bored him, but his anarchic sense of humor had helped to cement his reputation as a decent fellow, even if he kept his distance from the wild, strutting boys who spent their weekends dropping cherry bombs into mailboxes, shattering lampposts, and making obscene phone calls to the prettiest girls in the grade above them. In other words, Ferguson had breezed along so far without running into excessive difficulties, his good grades considered neither a plus nor a minus, his tactful, unaggressive approach to interpersonal relations having buffered him against the angers of other boys, which meant that he had been in few fistfights and seemed to have made no permanent enemies. But then, in the months before he turned 11, he decided he wanted to make a splash, which expressed itself in the form of a self-published one-sheet newspaper. And suddenly, his classmates understood that there was more to Ferguson than they had suspected, that he was really quite a clever young man, a crackerjack boy with the strength of mind to pull off an intricate stunt like the Crusader. And therefore, all 22 fellow members of his fifth-grade class coughed up their nickels for a copy of the first issue, congratulating him on his fine work, laughing at the funny turns of phrase that dotted his articles, and then the weekend came, and by Monday morning everyone had stopped talking about it. If the Crusader had ended after that first issue, Ferguson would have spared himself the grief that ultimately fell upon his head. But how could he have known there was a difference between being clever and too clever, that a second issue in the spring would start turning some of the class against him because it would prove that he was working too hard as opposed to their not hard enough, meaning that Ferguson was an industrious go-getter and they were little more than lazy, good-for-nothing louts. The girls were still with him, every one of the girls, but the girls weren't competing with him. It was the boys who were beginning to feel the pressure of Ferguson's diligence, three or four of them in any case. But Ferguson was too filled with his own happiness to notice, too flush with the triumph of completing another issue, to question why Ronnie Krolik and his band of hoodlums refused to buy the new edition of the Crusader when he brought it to school in April, thinking, if he thought about it at all, that they simply didn't have enough money. In Ferguson's opinion, newspapers were one of mankind's greatest inventions, and he had loved them ever since he had learned how to read. Early in the morning, 7 days a week, a copy of the Newark Star-Ledger would appear on the front steps of the house, landing with a pleasant thump just as he was climbing out of bed, thrown by some nameless, invisible person who never missed his mark. And by the time he was 6 and a half, Ferguson had already begun to take part in the morning ritual of reading the paper while he ate his breakfast, he who had willed himself to read during the summer of the broken leg, who had fought his way out of the prison of his childish stupidity and turned into a young citizen of the world, now advanced enough to comprehend everything, or almost everything but abstruse matters of economic policy, and the notion that building more nuclear weapons would ensure a lasting peace. And every morning he would sit at the breakfast table with his parents, as each one of them tackled a different section of the paper, reading in silence because talking was so difficult that early in the morning, and then passing around completed sections from one to the other in a kitchen filled with the smells of coffee and scrambled eggs, of bread warming and browning in the toaster, of butter melting into hot slabs of toast. For Ferguson, it was always the funnies and sports to begin with, the oddly appealing Nancy and her friend Sluggo, Jiggs and his wife Maggie, Blondie and Dagwood, Beetle Bailey, followed by the latest from Mantle and Ford, from Connerly and Gifford, and then on to the local news, the national and international news, articles about movies and plays, so-called human interest stories about the 17 college boys who crammed into a telephone booth, or the 36 hot dogs consumed by the winner of the Essex County Eating Contest. And when all those had been exhausted, and there were still a few minutes to spare before he set off to school, the classified ads and personals. "Darling, I love you. Please come home." The appeal of newspapers was altogether different from the appeal of books. Books were solid and permanent, and newspapers were flimsy, ephemeral throwaways, discarded the instant after they had been read, to be replaced by another one the next morning, every morning a fresh paper for the new day. Books moved forward in a straight line from beginning to end, whereas newspapers were always in several places at once, a hodgepodge of simultaneity and contradiction, with multiple stories coexisting on the same page, each one exposing a different aspect of the world, each one asserting an idea or a fact that had nothing to do with the one that stood beside it. A war on the right, an egg and spoon race on the left, a burning building at the top, a Girl Scout reunion at the bottom, big things and small things mixed together, tragic things on page one and frivolous things on page four, winter floods and police investigations, scientific discoveries and dessert recipes, deaths and births, advice to the Levlorn and crossword puzzles, touchdown passes and debates in Congress, cyclones and symphonies, labor strikes and transatlantic balloon voyages. The morning paper necessarily had to include each one of those events in its columns of black, smudgy ink, and every morning Ferguson exulted in the messiness of it all, for that was what the world was, he felt, a big, churning mess, with millions of different things happening in it at the same time. That was what the Crusader represented for him, a chance to create his own mess of a world and something that looked like a legitimate paper. Not truly legitimate, of course, no more than a rough approximation at best, but his young boy's amateur version of the real thing was close enough in spirit to make an impression on his friends. Ferguson had been hoping for that kind of response. He'd wanted to turn heads and make the class notice him. And now that his wish had been granted, he plunged into the second issue with an ever-growing sense of confidence, a new faith in the power of his own genius. And so blind had that faith become that not even the partial boycott by Krolik and his pals could make him see what was happening. It wasn't until the next morning that his eyes began to open somewhat. Michael Timmerman was one of his closest friends, a smart and popular boy whose grades were even better than Ferguson's, a quasi-heroic figure who towered over evil midgets like Ronnie Krolik in the way an oak towered over a patch of poison ivy. And when Michael Timmerman pulled you aside on the playground before school and said he wanted to talk, you were more than happy to listen to him. His first words were all about how good he thought the Crusader was, which pleased Ferguson enormously, since the opinion of the top athlete and scholar in the class weighed more than anyone else's opinion. But then Timmerman went on to say he would like to work with Ferguson, that he wanted to join the staff of the Crusader and contribute articles himself, which would make a good publication even better, he felt. For who had ever heard of a one-man newspaper? There was something weird and rinky-dink about having one reporter write all the articles. And if Ferguson gave him a chance and things worked out well, maybe there could eventually be three or four or five reporters. And if everyone chipped in some money to help with the printing costs, Maybe the Crusader could expand to 4 pages or 8 pages, with everything set in type, instead of depending on Ferguson's atrocious handwriting, and just like that, it would start to look like a real paper. Ferguson was not prepared for any of this. The Crusader had always been intended as a one-man show. His show. For better or worse, his show and no one else's. And the idea of sharing the stage with another boy, much less several other boys, made him ill with unhappiness. Timmerman was smothering him with his comments and suggestions, trying to strong-arm him into ceding control of his rinky-dink rag with its atrocious hand-printed letters. But didn't Timmerman realize that he had already thought about those things? That even if he had known how to type, he wouldn't have used a typewriter because the look would have been wrong, and because he couldn't afford to pay a printer, owing to the fact that he was 11 years old, he had opted for handwriting instead. And what did Timmerman know about his mother's deal with Meyerson to give a discount on portraits of his 3 children in exchange for the use of his printing equipment to run off the facsimiles? That was how things worked, he wanted to tell Timmerman. You bartered to cut down costs and did the best with what you had. And forget about chipping in to produce a so-called real paper. No 5 boys could ever raise enough money to afford that expense. And if Timmerman had been anyone other than his most admired friend, Ferguson would have told him to butt out of his business and start his own paper if he had so many bright ideas. But he respected Timmerman too much to speak his mind. He didn't want to risk insulting his friend, and so he took the coward's way out and hedged his bet, saying, "Let me think about it," instead of giving a clear yes or no, hoping time would dull Timmerman's newfound passion for journalism and that the matter would be forgotten in a couple of days. Like most successful boys, however, Timmerman was not someone who gave up easily or forgot. Every morning for the rest of the week, he approached Ferguson on the playground and asked if he had come to a decision. And every morning, Ferguson tried to put him off. "Maybe," he said, "maybe it's a good idea. But it's spring now, and there won't be enough time to put out another issue before the end of the school year. We're both busy with Little League these days, and you can't imagine how much work goes into it. Weeks of work, months of work. So much work that I'm not even sure I want to do it anymore. Give it a rest for a while, and maybe we can talk about it again over the summer." But Timmerman would be away at camp over the summer, and he wanted to resolve the question now. Even if the next issue wouldn't be coming out until the fall, he needed to know if he could count on it or not, and why in the world was Ferguson having so much trouble deciding what to do? What was the big deal? Ferguson understood that he was cornered. 4 straight days of badgering, and he knew it wouldn't stop until he gave an answer. But what was the right answer? If he told Timmerman he didn't want him, he would probably lose a friend. If he agreed to let Timmerman join the paper, he would despise himself for buckling in. A part of him was flattered by Timmerman's enthusiasm for the Crusader, and another part of him was beginning to dislike his friend, who was no longer acting like a friend but a smooth-talking bully. No, not quite a bully, but a manipulator. And because the manipulator was the most powerful and influential person in the class, Ferguson was loath to do anything that would offend him. For if Timmerman felt wronged by Ferguson, he could turn the entire class against him. And Ferguson's life would become an unrelenting misery for the rest of the school year. And yet he couldn't allow the Crusader to be destroyed just for the sake of preserving the peace. No matter what happened, he would still be trapped inside his own skin. And better to be turned into an outcast than to lose all respect for himself. On the other hand, even better not to be turned into an outcast if he could help it. Both yes and no were out of the question. What Ferguson needed was a maybe that would offer some hope without pinning him down to a lasting commitment. A delaying tactic camouflaged as a step forward, which in truth would be a step backward and a chance to buy more time. He proposed that Timmerman take on a test assignment to see if he enjoyed the work, and once he had written up the story, they could look at it together and decide if it belonged in the Crusader. Timmerman seemed to balk at first, looking none too pleased at the thought of having to be judged by Ferguson. But that was to be expected from a straight-A student with absolute confidence in his intellectual gifts, And so Ferguson was compelled to explain that the test was necessary because the Crusader was his thing and not Timmerman's. And if Timmerman wanted to be part of his thing, he would have to prove that his work fit in with the spirit of the enterprise, which was snappy, funny, and quick. It didn't matter how smart he was, Ferguson said. He had yet to write a single newspaper article. He had no experience at all. And how could they join forces unless they knew what his stuff sounded like? Fair enough, Timmerman said. He would write a sample piece and prove how good he was, and that would be that. This is what I'm thinking, Ferguson said. Who is your favorite movie actress and why? Talk to everyone in the class, every girl and every boy, and ask them all that one question. Who is your favorite movie actress and why? Be sure to write down every word they say, word for word, the exact answers they give you. And then go home and turn the results into a one-column story that will make people laugh when they read it. And if you can't make them laugh, at least make them smile, okay? Okay, Timmerman said. But why not favorite actor too? Because contests with one winner are better than contests with two winners. The actors can wait until the next issue. So Ferguson bought himself some time by sending Timmerman off on this useless make-work errand. And all was calm for the next 10 days as the rookie reporter gathered his data and set about to write the article. As Ferguson had suspected, Marilyn Monroe received the most votes from the boys, 6 out of 11, with the other 5 going to Elizabeth Taylor, 2, Grace Kelly, 2, and Audrey Hepburn, 1. But the girls gave Monroe only 2 of their 12 votes, with the other 10 distributed among Hepburn, 3, Taylor, 3, and 1 each to Kelly, Leslie Caron, Sid Charisse, and Deborah Carr. Ferguson himself hadn't been able to decide between Taylor and Kelly, so he'd flipped a coin and wound up giving his vote to Taylor, while Timmerman, faced with a similar dilemma between Kelly and Hepburn, had flipped the same coin and wound up going for Kelly. Complete nonsense, of course, but there was something amusing about it as well, and Ferguson noted how conscientiously Timmerman went about the business of interviewing the kids and jotting down their comments in his small, spiral-bound reporter's notebook. Top marks for legwork and industry then, but that was only the beginning, the foundation of the house, as it were, and it was still unclear what kind of structure Timmerman would be capable of building. There was no doubt that the boy had a good brain, but that didn't mean he could write well. During that 10-day period of watching and waiting, Ferguson lapsed into an odd state of ambivalence, becoming less and less sure of how he felt about Timmerman, uncertain whether he should go on resenting him or begin to show some gratitude for his hard work, 1 minute hoping he would fail with the article and the next moment hoping he would succeed, wondering if it might not be a good idea to have another reporter to share the load with him after all, realizing now that there was a certain satisfaction in assigning tasks to other people, that being the boss was not without its pleasures, for Timmerman had followed his orders without complaint. And that was a new feeling, the sense of being in charge. And if all went well with Timmerman's article, perhaps he should consider letting him in, not as a partner, of course, no, not that, never that, but as a contributing writer, the first of what could be several contributing writers, which could end up making it possible to expand the Crusader from 2 pages to 4. Perhaps. And then again, perhaps not, for Timmerman had yet to hand in the article, even though he had finished the interviews in 5 days. And now that another 5 days had gone by, Ferguson could only conclude that he was struggling with it. And if Timmerman was having a hard time, that probably meant the piece was no good. And anything less than good would be unacceptable. He would have to tell that to Timmerman's face. Imagine looking into the eyes of hotshot Michael Timmerman, he said to himself, the one person who had never failed at anything, and telling him he had failed. By the morning of the 10th day, Ferguson's hopes for the future had collapsed into a single wish that Timmerman was writing a masterpiece. As it turned out, the article wasn't bad, not horribly bad in any case, but it lacked the bounce Ferguson had been hoping for, the touch of humor that would have turned its trivial subject into something worth reading about. If there was any consolation in this letdown, it came from the fact that Timmerman seemed to think it was bad as well, or so Ferguson surmised from the author's self-deprecatory shrug when he handed him the finished manuscript on the playground that morning, accompanied by an apology for having taken so long to do the job. But it hadn't been as easy as he was expecting it to be, Timmerman said. He had rewritten the article 4 times, and if he had learned anything from the experience, it was that writing was a pretty tough business. Good, Ferguson said to himself. A little humility from Mr. Perfect. An admission of doubt, perhaps even an admission of defeat. And therefore, the confrontation he had been dreading most likely would not be taking place. Which was a good thing, a most excellent and reassuring thing, since Ferguson had spent the past days imagining fists flying into his stomach and summary banishments to the outer realms of the scorned. Still, he realized, if he wanted to keep their friendship intact, he would have to tread cautiously around Timmerman and make sure he didn't step on his toes. They were big toes, and the person they belonged to was a big boy. And amiable as that boy could be, he also had a temper, which Ferguson had witnessed several times over the years. Most recently, when Timmerman had decked Tommy Fuchs for calling him a stuck-up shit, the same Tommy Fuchs, who was known to his detractors as Tommy Fucks, and Ferguson had no wish to be fucked around by Timmerman as Tommy Fucks had been. He asked Timmerman to give him a few minutes, and then he withdrew to a corner of the playground and read the article. Quote, the question was, who is your favorite actress and why? A poll of the 23 students in Miss Van Horn's 5th grade class has given us the answer. Marilyn Monroe, who garnered 8 votes, winning out over Elizabeth Taylor, who came in 2nd with 5 votes. Timmerman had done a credible job of reporting the facts, but his language was bland, stiff to the point of lifelessness. And he had concentrated on the least interesting part of the story, the numbers, which were profoundly boring when compared to what the students had said about their choices. Comments Timmerman had shared with Ferguson and then had largely neglected to work into the piece. And as Ferguson recalled some of those statements now, he found himself beginning to rewrite the article in his head. Quote, va-va-voom, said Kevin Lassiter, needing just 3 short words to explain why Marilyn Monroe was his favorite movie actress. She seems like such a kind and intelligent person. I wish I knew her and could be her friend, said Peggy Goldstein, defending her choice of Deborah Carr. So elegant, so beautiful. I just can't tear my eyes away from her, said Gloria Dolan, about her number 1, Grace Kelly. Some dish, said Alex Botello, referring to his top star, Elizabeth Taylor. I mean, get a load of that body of hers. It makes a boy want to grow up real fast. Impossible to ask Timmerman to go back to the beginning and write the article for a 5th time. Useless to tell him that his work had produced neither a laugh nor a smile, and that he might be better served by focusing on the why instead of the who. It was too late to get into any of that now, and the last thing Ferguson wanted was to lord it over Timmerman and start lecturing him on what he should or shouldn't write. He walked back to where Mr. Bigtoes was standing and returned the article to him. Well, Timmerman said. Not bad, Ferguson replied. You mean not good? No, not good, not bad, which means pretty good. And what about the next issue? I don't know, I haven't even thought about it yet. But you're planning to do one, right? Maybe, maybe not. It's too soon to tell. Don't give up. You've started something good, Archie, and you've got to keep it going. Not if I don't feel like it, I don't. Anyway, why should you care? I still don't get why the Crusader is suddenly so important to you. Because it's exciting, that's why, and I want to be part of something exciting. I think it would be a lot of fun. Okay, I'll tell you what. If I decide to do another issue, I'll let you know. And give me a chance to write something? Sure, why not? You promise? To give you a chance? Yes, I promise. Even as he spoke those words, Ferguson knew that his promise meant nothing, since he had already made up his mind to shut down the Crusader for good. The 14-day battle with Timmerman had worn him out, and he was feeling depleted and uninspired, disgusted with himself for his weak-minded changes of heart, demoralized by his reluctance to stand up for himself and fight for his position, which was a 1-man paper or nothing. And now that he had made his splash and done what he had set out to do, perhaps it was better that it should be nothing. Better that he should get out of the pool, dry himself off, and call it quits. Besides, it was baseball season now, and he was busy playing for the West Orange Chamber of Commerce Pirates. And when he wasn't playing baseball, he was busy reading The Count of Monte Cristo, the immense book that Aunt Mildred had sent him last month for his 11th birthday, which he had finally started after the second issue of The Crusader had been put to bed. And now that he was in it, he was fully in it. For it was, without question, the most absorbing novel that had ever fallen into his hands. And how pleasant it was to be following the adventures of Edmond Dantès every night after dinner, instead of counting the words in his articles in order to fit them into the narrow columns of his broadsheet. So much labor, so many late nights squinting under his one-bulb lamp, forging on in the near black while his parents thought he was asleep. So many false starts and corrections, so many silent thanks to the man who had invented erasers. Knowing now that the job of writing was as much about removing words as adding them, and then the tedious work of going over every penciled letter with ink to make sure the words would be dark enough to be legible in the facsimiles. Exhausting, yes, that was the word for it. And after his prolonged and harrowing standoff with Timmerman, he was exhausted, and as any doctor would have told him, the only cure for exhaustion was rest. He rested for a month, finished the Dumas with a heavy heart, afraid that years might go by before he came across another novel as good as this one. And then, in the 3 days following his completion of the book, three things happened that changed his thinking and brought him out of retirement. He simply couldn't help himself. The words of a new headline had popped into his head. And so delightful were those words to him. So vivid was the rhyming jangle of their clattering consonants. So tricky was the way their apparent nonsense was in fact not nonsense but sense, that he longed to see those words in print. And so, reneging on his vow to leave the newspaper business, he started planning a third issue of The Crusader, which would carry his 1-2 punch of a headline in large letters across the front page, Fracas in Caracas. It began on May 13th. When Richard Nixon was attacked by a mob of Venezuelan protesters on the final stop of a three-country goodwill tour of South America. The vice president had just landed at the airport, and as his motorcade drove through the streets of downtown Caracas, the crowds lining the sidewalk chanted, "Death to Nixon! Nixon, go home!" And before long, Nixon's car was surrounded by scores of people, mostly young men, who began spitting on the car, smashing the windows, and a few moments after that, they were tipping the car from side to side, jostling it back and forth with such fury that it looked as if the car was about to turn over. And if not for the sudden appearance of Venezuelan soldiers, who dispersed the mob and cleared a path for Nixon's car to get away, things might have ended badly, quite badly for everyone concerned, especially for the almost murdered Nixon and his wife. Ferguson read about it in the paper the next morning, saw footage of the incident on the TV news that evening, and late the following afternoon, Cousin Francie, her husband Gary, and their 5-month-old baby stopped by the house for a visit. They lived in New York now, where Gary was about to finish his first year of law school at Columbia. And ever since Ferguson's performance as ring-bearer at the wedding ceremony 4 years earlier, Gary had treated his young cousin-in-law as a kind of protege, an up-and-coming fellow traveler in the world of ideas and manly pursuits, which had led to some long conversations about books and sports, but also about politics, which were something of an obsession for Gary, who subscribed to Dissent, I.F. Stone's Weekly, and the Partisan Review, and because Francie's husband was an intelligent young man, surely the best thinker Ferguson knew besides his Aunt Mildred, it was only natural that he should ask Gary what he thought about Nixon's run-in with the mob in Venezuela. They were outside in the backyard together, walking under the oak tree that Ferguson had fallen out of when he was 6. The tall, heavy-set Gary, puffing on a Parliament, as Ferguson's mother and Francie sat on the porch with baby Stephen. That plump little novice human being, as young in a relation to Ferguson as Ferguson had once been to Francie, and as the two women laughed together and took turns holding the baby, the didactic, ever-solemn Gary Hollander was talking to him about the Cold War, the Blacklist, the Red Scare, and the unhinged anti-communism that drove American foreign policy, which had led the State Department into supporting vicious right-wing dictatorships all around the world, especially in Central and South America. And that was why Nixon had been attacked, he said, not because he was Nixon, but because he represented the government of the United States. And that government was despised by vast numbers of people in those countries, justly despised, for backing the tyrants who oppressed them. Gary paused to light another parliament, and then he said, "You follow what I'm saying, Archie?" Ferguson nodded. "I get it," he said. "We're so scared of communism, we'll do anything to stop it, even if it means helping people who are worse than communists." The next morning, while reading the sports pages over breakfast, Ferguson stumbled across the word fracas for the first time. A Detroit pitcher had thrown a ball at a Chicago batter's head. The batter had dropped his bat, run to the mound, and punched the pitcher. And then the players from both teams had charged out onto the field and taken slugs at one another for the next 12 minutes. Once the fracas subsided, the reporter wrote, 6 players were ejected from the game. Ferguson looked over at his mother and said, "What does the word fracas mean?" "A big fight," she answered, "a commotion." "That's what I thought," he said. "I just needed to make sure." Months passed. The school year ended with no further trouble from Krolik, Timmerman, or anyone else. And then Miss Van Horn's 23 ex-pupils parted company for the summer vacation. Ferguson went off to Camp Paradise for his second 8-week stint there. And although most of his time was spent running around on ball fields and splashing in the lake, there were enough free hours during the post-lunch rest periods and the post-dinner lulls for him to write the articles and map out the design for the 3rd issue of The Crusader. He finished the job at home during the 2-week gap between the end of camp and the start of school, working every morning, afternoon, and most evenings in order to meet his self-imposed deadline of September 1st, which would give his mother enough time to run off the facsimiles at Meyerson's to have the issue ready by the first day of school. It would be a good way to begin the year, he felt, a little jolt to get things off to a fast start. And after that, he would see what he wanted to do, decide whether there should be more Crusaders or if this was in fact the last one. He had promised Timmerman he would let him know if there was going to be another issue. But all the articles had been written before he had a chance to contact him. He called Timmerman's house the day after he came home from camp, but the housekeeper told him that Michael and his parents and 2 brothers were on a fishing trip in the Adirondacks and wouldn't be returning until the day before school started. Earlier in the summer, Ferguson had considered writing the funny va-va-voom version of the movie actress story and putting it in the issue, but he had killed the idea out of deference to Timmerman's feelings. Understanding how cruel it would have been to run it, how hurt Timmerman would have been by such a witty demolition of his own dull effort. If he had kept Timmerman's version of the story, he might have considered publishing it as a courtesy, but he had given it back to him on the playground in April, and therefore it wasn't possible. A new issue of the Cobble Road Crusader was about to hit the jungle gyms and classrooms of Ferguson's elementary school, and Michael Timmerman knew nothing about it. That was his first mistake. His second mistake was that he remembered too much from his conversation with Gary in the backyard. The fracas and caracas was old news by then, but Ferguson couldn't let go of the phrase. It had been rattling in his head for months. So rather than use the headline for a report on what had happened to Nixon, he turned the piece into a boxed editorial in the middle of the front page, with fracas and caracas appearing just above the fold and the rest of the article just below it. Inspired by his talk with Gary, he argued that America should stop worrying about communism so much and listen to what people in other countries had to say. It was wrong to try to overturn the vice president's car, he wrote, but the men who did that were angry, and they were angry for a reason. They don't like America because they feel America is against them. That doesn't mean they're communists. It only means that they want to be free. First came the punch, the angry punch to his stomach as Timmerman yelled the word liar and knocked him to the ground. The last 21 copies of The Crusader, flew out of Ferguson's hands, and then they began to scatter across the schoolyard in the stiff morning wind, shooting past the other children like an army of stringless kites. Ferguson stood up and tried to deliver a punch of his own, but Timmerman, who seemed to have grown 3 or 4 inches over the summer, swatted it away and countered with another blow to the gut, which landed with far greater force than the first one had, not only knocking Ferguson to the ground again, but knocking the breath clear out of him. By then, Krolik, Tommy Fux, and several other boys were standing over Ferguson and laughing at him, taunting him with words that sounded like puss bucket, faggot, and cunt brain. And when Ferguson managed to stand up again, Timmerman pushed him to the ground for the third time, pushed him hard, which sent Ferguson crashing down on his left elbow, and within seconds the horrible funny bone pain had all but immobilized him, which gave Krolik and Fux enough time to start kicking dirt in his face. He closed his eyes. Somewhere in the distance, a girl was screaming. Then came the reprimands and punishments, the after-school detention, the idiot task of writing the words, "I will not fight in school," 200 times, the ceremonial bury-the-hatchet handshake with Timmerman, who refused to look into Ferguson's eyes, who would never look into his eyes again, who would go on hating Ferguson for the rest of his life. And then, just as they were about to be dismissed by their new sixth-grade teacher, Mr. Blasey, the principal's secretary walked into the classroom and told Ferguson that he was wanted downstairs in Mr. Jameson's office. "What about Michael?" Mr. Blasey asked. "No, not Michael," Miss O'Hara replied. "Just Archie." Ferguson found Mr. Jameson sitting behind his desk with a copy of the Cobble Road Crusader in his hands. He'd been in charge of the school for the past 5 years, and every year he seemed to grow a little shorter and rounder and to have a little less hair on his head. Brown hair to begin with, Ferguson remembered, but the thinning strands that were left had now turned gray. The principal didn't invite Ferguson to sit down, so Ferguson remained on his feet. "You understand that you're in serious trouble, don't you?" Mr. Jameson said. "Trouble?" Ferguson said. "I've just been punished. How can I still be in trouble?" "You and Timmerman were punished for fighting. I'm talking about this." Mr. Jameson tossed the Crusader onto his desk. "Tell me, Ferguson," the principal continued, "are you responsible for every article in this issue?" "Yes, sir, every word of every article." "No one helped you write anything?" "No one." "And your mother and father, did they read it in advance?" "My mother did. She helps me with the printing, so she gets to see it before anyone else. My father didn't read it until yesterday." "And what did they say to you about it?" "Nothing much. Nice job, Archie. Keep up the good work," something like that. "So you're telling me that the editorial and the front page was your idea?" "Fracas and Caracas? Yes, my idea." "Tell the truth, Ferguson. Who's been poisoning your mind with communist propaganda?" "What?" "Tell me, or else I'm going to have to suspend you for printing these lies." "I didn't lie." "You've just started the sixth grade. That means you're 11 years old, right?"
11 and a half.
"And you expect me to believe that a boy your age can come up with a political argument like this one? You're too young to be a traitor, Ferguson. It just isn't possible. Some older person must be feeding you this garbage, and I'm guessing it's your mother or father."
"They're not traitors, Mr. Jameson. They love their country."
"Then who's been talking to you?"
"No one."
"When you started your paper last year, I went along with it, didn't I? I even let you interview me for one of the articles. I found it charming. Just the sort of thing a bright young boy should be doing. No controversy, no politics. And then you go away for the summer and come back a red. What am I supposed to do with you?"
"If it's the Crusader that's causing the problem, Mr. Jameson, you don't have to worry about it anymore. There were only 50 copies of the back-to-school issue, and half of them blew away when the fight started. I've been on the fence about whether I should keep going with it, but after the fight this morning, my mind is made up. The Cobble Road Crusader is dead."
"Is that a promise, Ferguson?"
"So help me God."
"Stick to that promise, and maybe I'll try to forget that you deserve to be suspended."
"No, don't forget. I want to be suspended. Every boy in the sixth grade is against me now, and school is about the last place I want to be anymore. Suspend me for a long time, Mr. Jameson." Don't make jokes, Ferguson. I'm not joking. I'm the odd man out, and the longer I can stay away from here, the better off I'll be. His father was in a different line of work now. No more Three Brothers homeworld, but a vast weatherproof bubble that sat on the West Orange-South Orange border and was called the South Mountain Tennis Center. 6 indoor courts that allowed the tennis enthusiasts of the area to indulge their passion for the sport 12 months a year, to play during rainstorms and blizzards, to play at night, to play before the sun rose on winter mornings. 6 green, hard-surface courts, a pair of locker rooms equipped with sinks, toilets, and showers, and a pro shop that sold rackets, balls, sneakers, and tennis whites for men and women. The 1953 fire had been ruled an accident. The insurance company had paid up in full, and rather than rebuild or open another store in a new location, Ferguson's father had generously given his employee brothers a share of the money, $60,000 each, and had used the remaining $180,000 to put his tennis project into motion. Lou and Millie took off for southern Florida, where Lou became a promoter of dog races and highline matches, and Arnold opened a store in Morristown that specialized in children's birthday parties, stocking his shelves with bags of balloons, crepe paper streamers, candles, noisemakers, funny hats, and pin-the-tail-on-the-donkey posters. But New Jersey wasn't ready for such a novel concept, and when the store went out of business 2.5 years later, Arnold turned to Stanley for help and was given a job in the pro shop at the tennis center. As for Ferguson's father, every day of the 2.5 years it had taken Arnold to run his store into the ground had been spent in raising capital to augment the money he had invested on his own, searching for and eventually buying land, consulting with architects and contractors, and then, finally, erecting the South Mountain Tennis Center, which opened its doors in March 1956, 1 week after his son's 9th birthday. Ferguson liked the weatherproof bubble and the eerie, echoing sounds of tennis balls flying around in that cavernous space, the pop, pop, pop medley of rackets colliding with balls when several courts were in use at the same time, the intermittent squeaks of rubber soles jamming against the hard surfaces, the grunts and gasps, the long stretches when not a single word was spoken by anyone, the hushed solemnity of white-clad people batting white balls over white nets, a small, self-enclosed world that looked like no other place in the big world outside the dome. He felt that his father had done the right thing in changing jobs, that television sets and refrigerators and box spring mattresses can speak to you for just so long, and then a moment comes when you should jump ship and try something else. And because his father was so fond of tennis, why not earn his living from the game he loved? All the way back in 1953, in the spooky days after Three Brothers Homeworld burned to the ground, when his father was beginning to formulate his plan for the South Mountain Center, his mother had warned him of the risks involved in such a venture, the enormous gamble his father would be taking, and indeed there had been many ups and downs along the way. And even after the center had been built, it had taken some time before the membership ranks grew large enough for the incoming fees to surpass the monthly costs of running such a large operation, which meant that for most of the 3+ years between late 1953 and mid-1957, the Ferguson family had depended on the earnings of Roseland Photo to keep its head above water. Things had improved since then. The center and the studio were both running well in the black, generating enough income to provide for such extravagances as a new Buick for his father, a fresh paint job for the house, a mink stall for his mother, and 2 consecutive summers at sleepaway camp for Ferguson. But even though their circumstances were more comfortable now, Ferguson understood how hard his parents worked to maintain that comfort, how consuming their jobs were, and how little time they had for anything else, especially his father, who kept the tennis center open 7 days a week, from 6 a.m. until 10 p.m. And while he had a staff of employees to help him, Chuck O'Shea and Bill Abramovitz, for example, who could more or less run things on their own, and John Robinson, an ex-Pullman porter, who watched over the courts and locker rooms, and deadbeat Uncle Arnold, who ground out his hours in the pro shop smoking camels and flipping through newspapers and racing forms, and the three young assistants, Roger Niles, Ned Fortunato, and Richie Siegel, who rotated in 6 and 7 hour shifts, and half a dozen high school part-timers. Ferguson's father rarely took any days off during the cold weather months, and not many during the warm weather months either. Because his parents were so preoccupied, Ferguson tended to keep his troubles to himself. In the case of a dire emergency, he knew he could count on his mother to stand with him. But the fact was that there hadn't been any emergencies in the past couple of years, at least none bad enough to send him rushing to her for help. And now that he was 11 and a half, most of the situations that had once seemed dire to him had been reduced to a set of smaller problems he could solve on his own. Getting beaten up on the playground before the first day of school was no doubt a big problem. Being accused of spreading communist propaganda by the principal was unquestionably a big problem as well. But was either one of those problems grave enough to be considered dire? Forget that he had been close to tears after the smackdown in Mr. Jameson's office. Forget that he had gone on fighting back those tears during the entire walk home from school. It had been a wretched day, probably the worst day of his life since the day he fell out of the tree and fractured his leg, and there was every reason in the world for him to want to break down and cry. Punched by his friend, insulted by his other friends, with nothing but more punches and more insults to look forward to, and then the final indignity of being called a traitor by his dumb coward of a principal, who didn't even have the nerve to suspend him. Yes, Ferguson was feeling blue. Ferguson was struggling not to cry. Ferguson was in a tough spot, but what good would it do to tell his parents about it? His mother would be all sympathy, of course. She would want to hug him and take him in her arms. She would gladly turn him into a little boy again and hold him on her lap as he bawled forth his tearful lamentations. And then she would become angry on his behalf. She would threaten to call Mr. Jameson and give him a piece of her mind. A meeting would be arranged. The adults would argue about him. Everyone would be shouting about the pinko subversive and his pinko parents. And what good would that do? How could anything his mother said to him or did for him stop the next punch from coming? His father would be more practical about it. He would take out the boxing gloves and give Ferguson another lesson in the art of fisticuffs, the sweet science, as his father liked to call it, surely the worst misnomer in human history. And for 20 minutes he would demonstrate how to keep your guard up and defend yourself against a taller opponent. But what use were boxing gloves on a playground where people fought with bare knuckles and didn't follow the rules? Where it wasn't always one against one, but often 2 against 1, or 3 against 1, and even 4 against 1. Dire. Yes, perhaps it was dire. But father didn't know best, mother didn't know best, and therefore he would have to keep it to himself. No cries for help, not a word to either one of them. Just stick it out, stay clear of the playground, and hope he wasn't dead before Christmas. He lived in hell for the entire school year, but the nature of that hell and the laws that govern that hell kept shifting from month to month. He had assumed it would largely be a matter of punches, of being punched and then punching back as hard as he could. But big battles in the open air were off the agenda, and although he was often punched during the first weeks of school, he never had a chance to punch back, for the punches he received were delivered without warning. A boy rushing up to him out of nowhere, belting him in the arm or the back or the shoulder, and then running away before Ferguson could respond. Punches that hurt, one-blow sneak attacks when no one was looking. Always a different boy, 9 different boys from the 11 other boys in his class, as if they had all conferred with one another and worked out their strategy in advance. And once Ferguson had received those 9 punches from the 9 different boys, the punches stopped. After that, it was the cold shoulder, those same 9 boys refusing to talk to him, pretending not to hear Ferguson when he opened his mouth and said something, looking at him with blank, indifferent faces, acting as if he were invisible, a drop of nothingness dissolving into the empty air. Then came the period of pushing him to the ground, The old trick of one boy getting down on his hands and knees behind him while another boy pushed from the front, a quick shove to make him lose his balance, and then Ferguson would find himself tumbling over the crouching boy's back, and more than once his head hit the ground first. And not only was there the dishonor of being caught with his guard down once again, there was the pain. So much fun, so much laughter at his expense. And the boys were so cunning and efficient that Mr. Blasey never seemed to notice a thing. The defaced drawings, the scribbled-over math assignments, the missing lunch bags, the garbage in his cubby, the cut-off jacket sleeve, the snow in his galoshes, the dog turd in his desk. Winter was the time of pranks, the bitter season of indoor nastiness and ever-deepening despair. And then the ice thawed a couple of weeks after his 12th birthday, and a new round of punches began. If not for the girls, Ferguson surely would have crumbled to pieces. But none of the 12 girls in his class turned against him. And on top of that, there were the two boys who refused to take part in the savagery, the fat and slightly moronic Anthony DeLuca, variously known as Chubbs, Blubs, and Squish, who had always looked up to Ferguson and had often been victimized by Krolik and company in the past, and the new boy, Howard Small, quiet, intelligent kid who had moved to West Orange from Manhattan over the summer and was still feeling his way as a neophyte in the suburban hinterlands. In effect, the majority of the students were in Ferguson's camp, and because he wasn't alone, at least not altogether alone, he managed to tough it out by adhering to his three central principles. Never let them see you cry, never lash back in frustration or anger, and never breathe a word about it to anyone in authority, especially not his parents. It was a brutal and demoralizing business, of course, with countless tears shed into his pillow at night, ferocious, ever more elaborate dreams of revenge, prolonged descents into the rocky chasms of melancholia, a grotesque mental fugue in which he saw himself jumping off the top of the Empire State Building, silent harangues against the injustice of what was happening to him, accompanied by a fitful, frantic drumbeat of self-contempt, the secret conviction that he deserved to be punished because he had brought this horror upon himself. But that was in private. In public, he forced himself to be hard, to take the punches without emitting a single yelp of pain, ignoring them in the way you ignored ants on the ground or the weather in China, walking away from each new humiliation as if he were the victor in some cosmic struggle between good and evil, reining in any expression of sorrow or defeat because he knew the girls were watching. And the more bravely he stood up to his attackers, the more the girls would be on his side. It was also complicated. They were 12 years old now, or on the cusp of turning 12. And some of the boys and girls were beginning to pair off. The old divide between the sexes had narrowed to a point where male and female stood on almost common ground. Suddenly there was talk about boyfriends and girlfriends, about going steady. Nearly every weekend there were parties with dancing and spin-the-bottle games. And the same boys who just a year ago had tormented girls by pulling their hair and pinching their arms were now in favor of kissing them. Still the number one boy, Timmerman had forged a romantic alliance with the number one girl, Susie Kraus, and the two of them reigned over the class as a kind of royal couple, Mr. and Miss Popularity, 1959. It helped Ferguson that he and Susie had been friends since kindergarten, and that she was the leader of the anti-bully forces. When she and Timmerman became an item at the end of March, the atmosphere began to change somewhat. And before long, Ferguson noticed that he was being attacked less often and that fewer boys were attacking him. Nothing was ever said. Ferguson suspected that Susie had given her new beau an ultimatum. Stop torturing Archie or I'm gone. And because Timmerman was more interested in courting Susie than in hating Ferguson, he had backed off. He still treated Ferguson with contempt, but he stopped using his fists on him and no longer vandalized his belongings. And once Timmerman withdrew from the gang of nine, several other boys dropped out as well, since Timmerman was their leader and they followed him in all things. so that for the last 2.5 months of school, there were only 4 tormentors left, Krolik and his band of imbeciles. And while it was hardly pleasant to be given the treatment by those 4, it was far better than being worked over by 9. Susie wouldn't tell him whether she had spoken to Timmerman or not. Protocol demanded that she remain silent on the subject out of loyalty to her love. But Ferguson was almost certain she had, and so grateful was he to Susie Krause and her noble fighter's heart that he began to long for the day when she would eventually dump Timmerman and the field would open for him to try his luck with her. He thought about it continually throughout the early weeks of spring, deciding that it would probably be best to begin by asking her to spend a Saturday afternoon with him at his father's tennis center, where he could show her around and demonstrate how knowledgeable he was about the inner workings of the place, which would no doubt impress her and put her in the right mood for a kiss, or perhaps several kisses, and if not a kiss, then at least holding hands. Given the volatility of preteen romances in that corner of the New Jersey suburbs, where the average alliance lasted just 2 or 3 weeks, and 2 months of couplehood was the equivalent of a 10-year marriage, it was not unreasonable for Ferguson to hope that his opportunity would come before school let out for the summer. In the meantime, he had his eye on Gloria Dolan, who was prettier than Susie Krause, but not as exciting to be with. A gentle, plodding soul when compared to the sprinting spitfire Susie. And yet Ferguson had his eye on her because he had discovered that Gloria had her eye on him. Quite literally, she was looking at him when she thought he wasn't looking at her. And how many times in the past month had he caught her staring at him in class, sitting at her desk as Mr. Blasi turned his back to the students and worked out another math problem on the blackboard, no longer paying attention to the white chalk numerals, but studying Ferguson instead, as if Ferguson had become a subject of intense interest to her. And now that Ferguson had become aware of that interest, he too began turning his head away from the blackboard to look at her. And more often now their eyes would meet. And every time that happened, they would smile at each other. At that point in his journey through life, Ferguson was still waiting for his first kiss. His first kiss from a girl. A true kiss, as opposed to the fraudulent kisses from mothers, grandmothers, and female first cousins. An ardent kiss, an erotic kiss, a kiss that would go beyond the mere pressing of lips upon lips and send him flying into hitherto unexplored territory. He was ready for that kiss. He'd been thinking about it since before his birthday. In the past months, he and Howard Small had discussed the matter repeatedly and at length. Now that he and Gloria Dolan were exchanging secret smiles in class, Ferguson decided that Gloria should be the first one, for every signal pointed to the inevitability of her being the first one. And so it was on a Friday night at the end of April, during the course of a gathering at Peggy Goldstein's house on Merriwood Drive, that Ferguson took Gloria into the backyard and kissed her. And because she kissed him back, they went on kissing for a good long while. Far longer than he had imagined they would, perhaps 10 or 12 minutes, and when Gloria slipped her tongue into his mouth after the 4th or 5th minute, everything suddenly changed, and Ferguson understood that he was living in a new world and would never set foot in the old one again. Beyond those life-altering kisses with Gloria Dolan, the other good thing about that dismal year was his deepening friendship with the new boy, Howard Small. It helped that Howard had come from somewhere else, that he had entered the scene on the first fateful morning of the new school year without prejudices or preconceptions about who was who or who was supposed to be what, that he had bought the 3rd issue of the Cobble Road Crusader within minutes of reaching the playground and was happily scanning its contents when he saw the boy who had just sold it to him being attacked by Timmerman and the others. And because he was a person who knew right from wrong, he immediately took Ferguson's side and then stuck with Ferguson from that day forward. And because he too occasionally came under attack for the crime of being Ferguson's friend, the two boys grew close, since each would have been entirely alone if not for the existence of the other. 6th grade pariahs, and therefore friends, within a month the best of friends. Howard, not Howie, emphatically not Howie, small by name but not in size, just a fraction of an inch shorter than Ferguson, and already beginning to fill out. No longer a scrawny child, but an ever more robust preteen, solid and strong, physically unafraid, a kamikaze sportsman, who compensated for his mediocre abilities with relentless enthusiasm and effort. Wit and kindness, a fast learner with a talent for performing well under pressure, surpassing even Timmerman in 100% test scores, a reader of books as Ferguson was, a developing student of politics as Ferguson was, and a boy with a wondrous gift for drawing. The pencil he carried around in his pocket churned out landscapes, portraits, and still lifes of near photographic precision, but also cartoons and comics, which largely derived their humor from unlikely puns, words yanked out of their familiar roles because their sounds were congruent with the sounds of other unrelated words, such as the drawing entitled, "He Flies Through the Air with the Greatest of Ease," which showed a boy propelling himself across the sky with a large capital E in his outstretched hands, while other boys in the background struggled along with diminutive lowercase e's, or else Ferguson's favorite, the one in which Howard turned the word toiletries into a new form of vegetation, a drawing that bore the title Pinsky's Fruit Farm, with a row of cherry trees on top, neatly labeled cherry trees, and a row of orange trees in the middle, neatly labeled orange trees, and a row of toilet trees on the bottom, neatly labeled toilet trees. What a fine and funny idea, Ferguson thought, and what a good ear to have broken apart the original word and changed it into two words. But even more than the ear, it was the eye that counted, the eye in conjunction with the hand, since the result wouldn't have been half as effective if the toilets hanging from the branches hadn't been drawn so well. For Howard's toilets were nothing less than sublime, the most faithful and accurately rendered toilets Ferguson had ever seen. Howard's father was a math professor who had moved the Smalls to New Jersey because he had been offered a new post as dean of students at Montclair State Teachers College. Howard's mother worked as an editor for a women's magazine called Hearth and Home, which meant that she commuted to New York 5 days a week and seldom returned to West Orange before nightfall. And because Howard had a 20-year-old brother and an 18-year-old sister who were both off at college, his circumstances were remarkably similar to Ferguson's, a de facto only child who mostly came home to an empty house after school. Few suburban women had jobs in 1959, but Ferguson and his friend both had mothers who were more than just housewives, and consequently, they have been forced to become more independent and self-reliant than the bulk of their classmates. And now that they were 12 and careening toward the gate of adolescence, the fact that they had large swaths of unsupervised time to themselves was proving to be an advantage, since at that stage of life, parents were surely the least interesting people in the world, and the less one had to do with them, the better. They could therefore go to Ferguson's house after school and turn on the television to watch American Bandstand or Million Dollar Movie without fear of being reprimanded for squandering the last precious hours of daylight by sitting indoors on such a beautiful afternoon. Twice that spring, they even managed to talk Gloria Dolan and Peggy Goldstein into going back to the house with them for four-person dance parties in the living room. And because Ferguson and Gloria were old hands at kissing by then, their example inspired Howard and Peggy to attempt their own initiation into the complex art of tongue-bussing. On other afternoons, they would go to the Smalls' place instead, secure in the knowledge that they would not be interrupted or spied upon as they opened the bottom drawer of Howard's brother's desk and pulled out the pile of girly magazines he kept stashed in there under the innocuous decoy of a high school chemistry book. Long conversations would follow about which naked woman had the prettiest face or the most attractive body. Comparisons would be made between the models in Playboy and the ones in Gent and Swank, the slick, well-lit color photos of the quasi-unreal-looking Playboy women, as opposed to the cruder, grainier images in the cheaper magazines, the glossified all-American young beauties, and the older, more lascivious tramps with their harsh faces and bleach blonde hair. The point of the discussion always being which one was the most arousing to you, and which woman would you most like to make love to when your body was ready to engage in real sex, something that for the moment was still not possible for either one of them. But it wouldn't be long now. Maybe another 6 months, maybe a year. And finally, they would go to sleep one night and wake up the next morning to discover they were men. Ferguson had been tracking the changes in his body since the first sign of impending manhood appeared in the form of a single hair sprouting from his left armpit when he was 10 and a half. He knew what it meant and was surprised, since it seemed to have come too early. And at that point he was not prepared to say goodbye to the boy self that had belonged to him since birth. He found the hair ugly and ridiculous, an intruder sent by some alien force to mar his previously unblemished person, and therefore he plucked it out. Within days it had returned, however, along with an identical twin that arrived the following week, and then the right armpit swung into action as well, and before long the isolate strands were no longer distinguishable. The hairs were turning into nests of hair, and by the time he was 12, they had become a permanent fact of life. Ferguson watched with horror and fascination as other zones of his body were transformed as well, the almost invisible blondish down on his legs and forearms turning darker, thicker, and more abundant, the emergence of pubic hair on his once smooth lower belly, and then, just after he turned 13, the odious black fuzz that began germinating between his nose and upper lip, so disgusting and disfiguring that he shaved it off one morning with his father's electric razor, and when it grew back a couple of weeks later, he shaved it off again. The horror was not being in control of what was happening to him. A feeling that his body had been turned into the site of an experiment conducted by some mad prankster scientist. And his new hair continued to proliferate over greater and greater areas of his skin. He couldn't help thinking about the Wolfman, the hero of that gruesome film he had seen with Howard on television one night back in the fall, the metamorphosis of a normal man into a woolly-faced monster, which Ferguson now understood was a parable about the helplessness one experiences during puberty. For you are doomed to become whatever your genes have decided you will be. And until the process is finished, you have no idea what the next day will bring. That was the horror of it. But along with the horror, there was fascination. The knowledge that however long and difficult the journey might be, would eventually lead to the kingdom of erotic bliss. The problem was that Ferguson still knew nothing about the nature of that bliss, and struggle as he did to imagine what his body would feel in the throes of an orgasm, Ferguson's imagination continually failed him. His early double-digit years were filled with rumors and hearsay, but no hard facts. Mysterious, unconfirmed stories from boys with older adolescent brothers that alluded to the unlikely spasms involved in the attainment of erotic bliss. The pulsing streams of milky white fluid that spurted out of your penis, for example, which sometimes traveled several feet or even yards through the air. The so-called ejaculation, which was always accompanied by that much sought-after blissful feeling, which Howard's brother Tom described as the best feeling in the world. But when Ferguson pressed him to be more specific and describe what that feeling was, Tom said he wouldn't know where to begin. It was too hard to put into words, and Ferguson would simply have to wait until the time came for him to feel it himself, a frustrating answer that did nothing to alleviate Ferguson's ignorance. And while some of the technical terms were now familiar to him, such as the word semen, which was the sticky stuff that shot out of you and carried the sperm that were essential for creating babies, Ferguson invariably thought of a shipful of sailors whenever someone used that word in his presence. Merchant seamen, dressed in milky white uniforms, coming ashore and heading for honky-tonk bars along the docks to flirt with half-naked women and join the old salts in drunken sea chanties as a one-legged man in a striped shirt blasted out the tune on his ancient concertina. Poor Ferguson. His mind was in a muddle, and because he still couldn't imagine what any of the words really meant, his thoughts tended to dart out in several directions at once. Seaman, S-E-A, would soon become Seaman, S-E-E, and an instant later he would imagine he was blind, tapping his way into the noisy bar with a white cane in his hand. It was clear that the central actor in this drama was his groin, or, to hark back to the terminology of the ancient Hebrews, his loins. That is to say, his privates, which in the medical literature were commonly referred to as genitalia. For as long as he could remember being himself, it had always felt good to touch himself down there, to fiddle with his penis when no one was looking, in bed at night or early in the morning, for example, manipulating that fleshy extrusion until it rose up stiffly in the air, doubling or tripling or even quadrupling in size, and with that startling mutation, an inchoate sort of pleasure would begin to spread through his body, particularly the lower half of his body, a formless rush of feeling that was not yet bliss but suggested that bliss would one day be achieved by a similar kind of friction. He was growing steadily now. Every morning his body seemed to be a little larger than it had been the day before, and the growth of his penis was keeping pace with the rest of him, no longer the nubby dicky bird of pre-hair childhood, but an ever more substantial appendage, which now seemed to possess a mind of its own, lengthening and hardening at the least provocation, especially on those afternoons when he and Howard studied Tom's nudie magazines. They were in junior high school now, and one day Howard repeated a joke he had been told by his brother. A science teacher asked his students, "What part of the body can expand to 6 times its normal size?" He points his finger at Miss McGillicuddy, but instead of answering the question, the girl begins to blush and covers her face with her hands. The teacher then points at Mr. McDonald, who quickly responds, "The pupils of the eyes." "Correct," says the teacher, and then he turns back to the blushing Miss McGillicuddy and addresses her with an irritation bordering on contempt. "I have 3 things to tell you, young lady," he says. "1, you haven't been doing your homework. 2, you have a dirty, filthy mind. And 3, you're in for a life of bitter disappointment." Not 6 times, then, not even after he was fully grown. There were limits to what he could expect from the future. But whatever the exact measurements were, whatever the proportions between soft repose and hard readiness, the increase would be sufficient unto the day, and the night of that day, and all the nights and days that followed. Junior high was unquestionably superior to the grammar school that had held him prisoner for the past 7 years, and with more than 1,000 students charging through the halls at the end of each 50-minute period, he no longer had to endure the suffocating intimacy of being trapped in a room with the same 23 or 24 people every Monday through Friday from the beginning of September to the end of June. The Gang of Nine was a thing of the past, and even Krolik and his 3 toadies had essentially disappeared from view, since Ferguson rarely crossed paths with them anymore. Timmerman was still present, a fellow class member in 4 of Ferguson's academic subjects, but the 2 boys coexisted by going out of their way to ignore each other, a less than happy standoff, but not an unbearable one. Better yet, Timmerman and Susie Krause had parted ways, just as Ferguson had hoped they would, and because Ferguson himself had lost contact with Gloria Dolan over the summer, his first kissing mate had now cast her eyes on handsome Mark Connolly, which disappointed Ferguson, but didn't entirely crush him, since a path had been opened for him to go after Susie Krause, the girl of his 6th-grade dreams, and he jumped at his chance by calling her one evening during the first week of school, which led to a Saturday afternoon visit to his father's tennis center, which in turn led to their first kiss the following Saturday, and many other kisses on subsequent Fridays and Saturdays over the next few months, and then they too parted ways, with Susie falling into the arms of the aforementioned Mark Connolly, who had lost Gloria Dolan to a boy named Rick Bassini, and Ferguson pining for an ever more attractive Peggy Goldstein, who had broken off with Howard some time ago, but Ferguson's best friend had recovered with his heart intact and was now offering that same heart to the bright and bubbly Edie Cantor. So it went throughout that year of ephemeral crushes and round-robin loves, which was also the year when more and more of his friends turned up at school with braces on their teeth, and the year when everyone began to worry about outbreaks of bad skin. Ferguson felt lucky. So far, his face had been attacked by just 3 or 4 modest volcanoes, which he had popped at the first opportunity, and his parents had decided his teeth were straight enough to spare him the ordeals of orthodontia. More than that, they had insisted he go back to Camp Paradise for another summer. He had assumed that 13 was perhaps a bit too old for camp, and had therefore asked his father, over the Christmas holidays, if he could spend July and August working at the tennis center. But his father had laughed, saying there would be plenty of time for work later. "You need to be out in the air, Archie," his father told him, "running around with boys your own age. Besides, you can't get your working papers until you're 14. Not in New Jersey, you can't. And you wouldn't want to get me into trouble for breaking the law, would you?" Ferguson was happy at camp. He had always been happy there. And it was good to be reunited with his New York summer friends, the half-dozen city boys who kept going back year after year as he did. He took pleasure in the eternal sarcasm and humor of their fast-talking, high-spirited selves, which often reminded him of the way American soldiers spoke to one another in movies about World War II, the jocular, wisecracking banter, the compulsion never to take anything seriously, to turn every situation into an excuse for yet another joke or mocking aside. No doubt there was something admirable about attacking life with such wit and irreverence, but it could also be wearisome at times, and whenever Ferguson had his fill of his cabin mate's verbal antics, he would find himself missing Howard, his close friend of the past 2 years, the closest friend he had ever had. And with Howard far away at his aunt and uncle's dairy farm in Vermont, where he spent all his summers, Ferguson began writing letters to him during the one-hour rest period after lunch, numerous short and long letters in which he set down whatever he happened to be thinking about at the moment. For Howard was the one person in the world he could unburden himself to, the one person he was not afraid to trust or confide in, the singular, unimpeachable friend with whom he could share everything. From criticisms of other people, to comments about books he had read, to musings about the difficulty of suppressing farts in public, to thoughts about God. There were 16 letters in all, and Howard kept them in a square wooden box, holding on to them even after he had grown up and begun his life as an adult. Because the 13-year-old Ferguson, his friend of the straight teeth and shining countenance, the founder of the long-defunct but never forgotten Cobble Road Crusader, the boy who had broken his leg at 6 and gashed his foot at 3 and nearly drowned at 5, who had weathered the depredations of the Gang of 9 and the Band of 4, who had kissed Gloria Dolan and Susie Krauss and Peggy Goldstein, who had been counting the days until he entered the kingdom of erotic bliss, who had assumed and expected and entirely taken for granted that there were many years of life still in front of him, did not live to the end of the summer. That was why Howard Small saved those 16 letters, because they were the last traces of Ferguson's presence on this earth. "I don't believe in God anymore," he wrote in one of them, "at least not the God of Judaism, Christianity, or any other religion. The Bible says that God created man in his own image. But men wrote the Bible, didn't they? Which means that man created God in his image, which also means that God doesn't watch over us, and he certainly doesn't give a damn about what men think or do or feel. If he cared about us at all, he wouldn't have made a world with so many terrible things in it. Men wouldn't fight wars and kill each other and build concentration camps. They wouldn't lie and cheat and steal. I'm not saying that God didn't create the world. No man did that. But once the job was done, he disappeared into the atoms and molecules of the universe and left us to fight it out among ourselves." "I'm glad Kennedy won the nomination," he wrote in another letter. "I liked him better than the other candidates, and I'm sure he'll beat Nixon in the fall. I don't know why I'm sure, but it's hard to imagine Americans wanting a man called Tricky Dick to be their president." "There are 6 other boys in my cabin," he wrote in another letter, "and 3 of them are old enough to do it now. They jerk off in their beds at night and tell the rest of us how good it feels. 2 days ago, they did what they call a circle jerk and let us watch, so I finally saw what the stuff looks like and how far it spurts. It's not milky white, but a sort of creamy white, a bit like mayonnaise or hair tonic. Then one of the three jerk-off kings, a guy named Andy, got another boner and did something that amazed me and everyone else. He bent over and sucked his own dick. I didn't know it was humanly possible to do that. I mean, how could anyone be flexible enough to twist his body into that position? I tried to do it myself in the bathroom yesterday morning, but I couldn't get my mouth anywhere near my dick. Just as well, I suppose. I wouldn't want to walk around thinking of myself as a cocksucker, would I? But still, what a strange thing it was to see. I've read three books since I've been here, he wrote in the last letter, which was dated August 9th, and I thought they were all terrific. Two of them were sent to me by my Aunt Mildred, a little one by Franz Kafka called The Metamorphosis, and a bigger one by J.D. Salinger called The Catcher in the Rye. The other one was given to me by my cousin Francie's husband, Gary, Candide by Voltaire. The Kafka book is by far the weirdest and most difficult to read, but I loved it. A man wakes up one morning and discovers that he's been turned into an enormous insect. It sounds like science fiction or a horror story, but it isn't. It's about the man's soul. The Catcher in the Rye is about a high school boy wandering around New York. Nothing much happens in it, but the way Holden talks, he's the hero, is very realistic and true, and you can't help liking him and wishing you could be his friend. Candide is an old book from the 18th century, but it's wild and funny, and I laughed out loud on almost every page. Gary called it a political satire. I call it great stuff. You must read it, and the other ones too. Now that I've finished them all, what strikes me is how different these three books are. They're all written in their own way, and they're all very good, which means that there isn't just one way to write a good book. Last year, Mr. Dempsey kept telling us there was a right way and a wrong way, remember? Maybe with math and science there are, but not with books. You do them in your own way, and if your way is a good way, you can write a good book. The interesting thing is that I can't decide which one I liked best. You'd think I would know, but I don't. I love them all, which means, I guess, that any good way is the right way. It makes me happy to think about all the books I still haven't read. Hundreds of them. Thousands of them. So much to look forward to. The last day of Ferguson's life, August 10th, 1960, began with a brief rain shower just after dawn. But by the time reveille sounded at 7:30, the clouds had blown off to the east, and the sky was blue. Ferguson and his six cabin mates headed to the mess hall with their counselor, Bill Kaufman, who had finished his sophomore year at Brooklyn College in June. And during the 30 or 40 minutes it took them to eat their oatmeal and scrambled eggs, the clouds returned, and as the boys walked back to the cabin for cleanup and inspection, rain was beginning to fall again. A rain so fine and inconsequential that it hardly seemed to matter that no one was wearing a poncho or carrying an umbrella. Their t-shirts were covered with dark specks of moisture, but that was the extent of it, the mildest of mild dousings, water in such small quantities that it didn't even make them wet. As they started in on the morning ritual of making their beds and sweeping the floor, however, the sky continued to darken, and before long the rain began to fall in earnest, hitting the roof of the cabin with larger, ever more accelerated drops. For a minute or two, there was a lovely sort of off-key syncopation to the sound, Ferguson felt, but then the intensity of the rain increased, and the effect was lost. The rain wasn't making music anymore. It had turned into a mass of dense, undifferentiated sound, a percussive blur. Bill told them that a new weather system was heading in from the south, and with a cold front simultaneously coming down from the north, they could expect a long, hard soak. "Get comfortable, boys," he said. "It's going to be a big storm, and we'll be sitting in this cabin for most of the day." The dark sky grew even darker, and inside the cabin it was becoming difficult to see. Bill switched on the overhead light, but even after the light came on, it still felt dark in there, for the 75-watt bulb was too high up in the rafters to illuminate much of anything down below. Ferguson was on his bed, flipping through a back issue of Mad magazine that had been circulating around the cabin, reading with the aid of his flashlight, and wondering if any morning had ever been as dark as this one. The rain was battering the roof now, a full-bore assault. pounding on the shingles as if the liquid drops had turned to stone. Millions of stones were falling from the sky and hammering down on them. And then, far off in the distance, Ferguson heard a dull basso rumbling, a thick, congested noise that made him think of someone clearing his throat, a thunder that must have been many miles away from them, somewhere in the mountains, perhaps. And this struck Ferguson as odd, since in his experience the thunder and lightning of electric storms had always come in tandem with the rain. But in this instance, it was already raining, raining as hard as it could possibly rain, and the thunder was still nowhere near them, which led Ferguson to speculate that perhaps there were two storms going on at once, not just a storm and a cold front, as Bill had said, but two separate storms, one directly overhead and the other approaching from the north. And if the first storm didn't play itself out before the second storm arrived, the two storms would crash into each other and merge. And that would create one hell of a mighty storm, Ferguson said to himself, a monumental storm, the storm to end all storms. The bed to the right of Ferguson's was occupied by a boy named Hal Krasner. Since the beginning of the summer, the two of them had kept up a running gag in which they impersonated Smart George and Stupid Lenny, the drifters from Of Mice and Men, a book they had both read earlier in the year and found ripe with comic possibilities. Ferguson was George and Krasner was Lenny, and nearly every day they would spend a few minutes improvising crackpot dialogues for their chosen characters, a steady round of nonsense that would begin with Lenny asking George to tell him what it was going to be like when they got to heaven, for example, or George reminding Lenny not to pick his nose in public, idiotic exchanges that probably owed more to Laurel and Hardy than to Steinbeck, but it amused the boys to indulge in these shenanigans, and with rain now pouring down on the camp and everyone stuck inside, Krasner was in the mood to have another go at it. "Please, George," he said, "please make it stop. I can't stand it no more." "Make what stop, Lenny?" Ferguson asked. "The rain, George, the noise of the rain. It's too loud and it's beginning to drive me crazy." "You've always been crazy, Lenny, you know that." "Not crazy, George, just stupid." "Stupid, yes, but also crazy. I can't help it, George, I was born that way." "No one's saying it's your fault, Lenny." "Well?" "Well, what?" "Are you going to stop the rain for me?" "Only the boss can do that." "But you're the boss, George. You've always been the boss. I mean, the big boss, the one and only." "I don't know, no one and only. I only know you, George." "It would take a miracle to pull off a thing like that." "That's all right. You can do anything." "Can I? The noise is making me sick, George. I think I'll die if you don't do it." Krasner put his hands over his ears and moaned. He was Lenny telling George that he had come to the limit of his strength. And Ferguson, as George, nodded in sad commiseration, knowing that no man could stop the rain from falling, that miracles were beyond the scope of mankind's power. But Ferguson, as Ferguson, was having trouble keeping up his end of the act. Krasner's sick cow moans were simply too funny, and after listening to them for another few seconds, Ferguson burst out laughing, which broke the spell of the charade for him, although not for Krasner, who assumed that Ferguson was laughing as George, and therefore, still posing as Lenny, Krasner removed his hands from his ears and said, "It ain't nice to laugh at a man like that, George. I might not be the smartest guy in the county, but I got a soul, just like you and everyone else. And if you don't wipe that grin off your face, I'll snap your neck in two, just like I done to them rabbits." Now that Krasner, as Lenny, had delivered such an earnest and effective speech, Ferguson felt obliged to force himself back into character, to become George again for Krasner's sake and the sake of the other boys who were listening to them. But just as he was about to open his lungs and shout out an order for the rain to stop, "Enough for the waterworks, boss," the sky blasted forth a piercing clap of thunder, a noise so loud and so explosive that it shook the floor of the cabin and rattled the window frames, which went on humming and vibrating until the next burst of thunder rattled them again. Half of the boys jumped, jerked forward, twitched involuntarily in response to the sounds, while others called out by pure reflex, the air shooting from their lungs in short, startled exclamations that seemed to be words but were in fact instinctive grunts in the form of words. Wow, whoa, wah. The rain was still coming down hard, lashing against the windows and making it difficult to see anything through them. Nothing more than a wavy, watery darkness, lit up by sudden spears of lightning, all black for 10 or 20 heartbeats, and then a moment or two of blinding white light. The storm that Ferguson had imagined, the vast double storm that would fuse into one storm when the air from the north and the air from the south collided, was upon them now, and it was even bigger and better than he had hoped it would be. A grand tempest, an axe of fury tearing apart the heavens, an exhilaration. "Don't worry, Lenny," he said to Krasner. "There's no need to be scared. I'm going to put an end to this noise right now." Without pausing to tell anyone what he was about to do, Ferguson leapt off his bed and ran for the door, which he yanked open with a hard, two-handed tug. And even though he could hear Bill's voice shouting behind them, "What the hell, Archie? Are you crazy?" he didn't stop. He understood that it was indeed a crazy thing to be doing. But the fact was that he wanted to be crazy just then, and he wanted to be out in the storm, to taste the storm, to be part of the storm, to be inside the storm for as long as it took for the storm to be inside him. The rain was superb. Once Ferguson crossed the threshold and stepped out onto the ground, he realized that no rain had ever fallen harder, that the drops of this rain were thicker and traveling faster than any other drops he had known, that they were rushing down from the sky with the force of lead pellets and were heavy enough to bruise his skin and perhaps even dent his skull. A magnificent rain, an all-powerful rain. But in order to savor it to the fullest, he figured he should run to the cluster of oaks that stood about 20 yards in front of him, for the leaves and branches would protect his body from those falling bullets. And so Ferguson made a break for it, dashing across the soggy, slippery ground toward the trees, splashing through ankle-deep puddles as thunder boomed above him and around him, and bolts of lightning shot down within yards of his feet. He was thoroughly soaked by the time he got there, but it felt good to be soaked. It was the best of all good feelings to be soaked like that. And Ferguson felt happy, happier than he had been at any time that summer, or any other time of his life. For surely this was the greatest thing he had ever done. There was little or no wind. The storm wasn't a hurricane or a typhoon. It was a raging downpour, with thunder to stir up his bones and lightning to dazzle his eyes. And Ferguson wasn't the least bit afraid of that lightning, since he was wearing sneakers and had no metal objects with him, not even a wristwatch or a belt with a silver buckle. And therefore he felt safe and exultant under the shelter of the trees, looking out at the gray wall of water that stood between him and the cabin, watching the dim, almost entirely obscured figure of his counselor Bill, who was standing in the open doorway and seemed to be shouting to him, or shouting at him as he gestured for Ferguson to come back to the cabin. But Ferguson couldn't hear a word he was saying, not with the noise of the rain and the thunder, and especially not when Ferguson himself began to howl, no longer George on his mission to save Lenny, but simply Ferguson himself, a 13-year-old boy wailing in exultation at the thought of being alive in such a world as the one he had been given that morning. And even when a shaft of lightning struck the top branch of one of the trees, Ferguson paid no attention to it, for he knew he was safe. And then he saw that Bill had left the cabin and was running toward him. Why in the world would he do that? Ferguson asked himself. But before he could answer the question, the branch had broken off from the tree and was falling toward Ferguson's head. He felt the impact, felt the wood crack down on him as if someone had clubbed him from behind. And then he felt nothing, nothing at all, or ever again. And as his inert body lay on the water-soaked ground, the rain continued to pour down on him, and the thunder continued to crack. And from one end of the earth to the other, the gods were silent.